Hey, I'm Michaela. I work at First Person Arts, and I'm a native Philadelphian. So, baby Evie is my doll. I got this doll when I was probably 2, and I went to a Waldorf preschool. And that is significant only because baby Evie is a Waldorf doll. And if you don't know what Waldorf is, it's very crunchy, hippie education. From what I understand it is, it's all about like the kid being able to use their imagination as much as possible. There was nothing in my preschool classroom made out of plastic. Side note, I didn't learn the alphabet in preschool. So super minimalist education, very focused on play, imagination. And so baby Evie is a doll that is very much in that Waldorf philosophy. Really minimalist features, doesn't have a full head of hair, just little eyes and a mouth for their face, and then like made out of wool and cotton and like a knit material for the skin, a little knit hat, and then this like full body jumpsuit that is velvet. There's like a little tuft of blonde hair made out of, I think, embroidery thread that sort of like pokes out of her hat. I don't ever know how to refer to this baby because like it's so minimalist that I remember like there were times where like baby Evie was a boy and times where baby Evie was a girl. Baby Evie, queer icon. Baby Evie is just this like comfort object. Baby Evie has sort of always just like lived in the bed. Because I think there was also like a period of time where like my parents started to realize probably how like this is not an object that we could lose. And so baby Evie doesn't come to sleepovers or school or anywhere. I remember like going on trips and kind of being like, I want to take baby Evie, but then if I lose her in blah, 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 you know, there's no coming back. As I got older, I had other dolls, Barbies, which I got as a gift. My mom wasn't super happy about that. A Polly Pocket, an American Girl doll that I used to spend all of my allowances and babysitting earnings on buying outfits for. And all of these dolls were very much about buying things and accessories. You can change their outfits, which is kind of the opposite of Baby Evie. Like, you could not change his outfit. There's nothing to add. It's like the intention is for it to be what you imagine. So yeah, even through high school, I slept with baby Evie living in my bed. And then when I went to college, I just didn't take her with me. I had like teddy bear that I kind of wanted to take. I didn't want to be the person with a bunch of stuffed animals at college. So I just took the one and baby Evie stayed at home. And again, part of the calculation is like baby Evie lives in this bed, like that's his safety zone. So I think college also felt like an environment, like what if something happens to baby Evie? I go to college, baby Evie stays in my childhood bedroom at my parents' house. I remember leaving and making my bed and baby Evie lying on the pillow, you know, kind of waiting there for me when I came home. And then over time, that became less significant. I didn't tuck them in to wait for me because leaving for college and coming home from college became more and more normal and less of like this ritual that it was that first time. You know, it's still all love with baby Evie, but there isn't this attachment. And so I think at one point there was a basket of a couple of stuffed animals that got, you know, lovingly placed in the back of a closet. And then as more things came home, that got shoved, you know, further back and had other stuff placed on top of it. And it was sort of crushed and forgotten. And yeah, baby Evie was in that basket.
From WHYY, you're listening to Philadelphia Revealed. I'm your host, Jamie J., Executive Director of First Person Arts, a nonprofit organization that believes everyone has a story to tell. Across 10 episodes, you're going to get a tour of the Atwater Kent Collection, sometimes called Philadelphia's Attic. It's a collection that's grown over decades, acquiring Philly's material culture from individuals, families, institutions, sometimes literally from the trash. In every episode of this podcast, you'll learn about an object in the Atwater Kent collection and hear a story inspired by it from a first-person art storyteller. We think every Philadelphian will be able to see themselves in this collection. and that learning about Philadelphia's many histories can help us understand its present and future. This is Episode 9, Nothing to Wear, with storyteller Michaela Prell. Michaela is a native Philadelphian. By day, they work as the operations manager and archivist at First Person Arts. And by night, they follow their favorite band, Soup Dreams, all over Philly. They were drawn to the Atwater Kent's extensive doll collection. There are about 250 dolls in the collection, spanning over 200 years, from simple handmade dolls like Michaela's to porcelain dolls and vintage Barbies. But there was one doll in particular that really caught Michaela's eye. It's a doll from 1864, nicknamed Flora McFlimsey.
I was drawn to Flora McFlimsey because this doll's preservation made me think of my doll from childhood and its lack of preservation. Flora has sort of a baby face. It's like very round and cherub-like, but she has the body of an adult doll. She's wearing this very fancy old-timey dress, a waistcoat and a big skirt, kind of a Peter Pan collar. She has a lot of hair and it's braided up into almost like Leia from Star Wars buns. She's very like postured and upright. She looks very hoity-toity.
Flora McFlimsey is this wonderful porcelain doll, hand-painted with a porcelain head, cloth extremities, and a fairly extensive collection of clothing and apparel and accessories.
She has like tiny little lips, the thinnest eyebrows, and then these like big eyes.
Just a lovely Victorian doll.
That's Stacy Swigert, director of the Atwater Kent Collection. And Michaela had questions for Stacy.
Is this doll meant to be like an action figure in the way I might have a Spider-Man doll or action figure? Or is this a doll that also has a story to go with her, kind of like American Girl doll? Or if this is like someone's baby doll? Was this object someone's actual doll that they owned and played with? And if so, do we know whose?
She was created in part because there was this satirical poem that was published in Harper's Weekly, and the author's name was William Allen Butler.
Flora McFlimsey didn't start out as a doll, but as a character in a long-rhyming poem called Nothing to Wear.
It's a poem, but it's a kind of a long poem. They published it in parts over the course of a series of months in 1857, kind of a serial that came out in dribs and drabs. This writer was actually an attorney who liked to write satirical poetry, and it became an instant hit. And it was all about Flora McFlimsey and the aspect that she had nothing to wear.
By the end of 1857, the entire poem was released as a book.
We didn't have it in the collection, but I found it at an antique book sale. It's this slip-covered copy from 1857 of Nothing to Wear, and you pull out this great little cover, and it's this embossed book with the gold gilt Nothing to Wear illustrated. So it says, Nothing to Wear, an episode of City Life. Miss Flora McFlimsey of Madison Square has made three separate journeys to Paris, and her father assures me each time she was there that she and her friend, Mrs. Harris, not the lady whose name is so famous in history, but plain Mrs. H. without romance or mystery, spent six consecutive weeks without stopping in one continuous round of shopping. It talks about all the things that they're buying and seeing and eating and drinking and buying and seeing and still has nothing left to wear. Why it resonated with the American public, I don't know, but it sure did. People loved the story.
So I read this book, long poem, and yeah, it just is like a read on all women who like to wear clothes everywhere.
Michaela didn't know what to make of the poem at first. It's supposed to be a satire, but what's the satire? The book is narrated by a man who seems to be dating Flora,
and is observing her shopping habits.
It just is very like women be shopping. It's just like no matter what she wore, she was never happy. And I asked her to go out to the ball with me and she said I didn't have anything to wear. And I was like, what about the purple one? And she's like, no, I can't wear that one. I wore it last time. And he's like, what about the teal dress? And she's like, no, teal isn't right for this kind of weather. What about the tan dress? That's being cleaned. But then she's like constantly going to Paris and buying more clothes. It's just like this very particular version of womanhood, of like having high expectations. She gets engaged to the guy in the book and then like is still like dating other guys, and he's like, I thought we were engaged. And he's like, we were, but I want to date other guys. And he's like, this is all in rhyme, of course. And he's like, well, I'm not gonna date anyone else. And she's like, yeah, you can't. I just like don't know how to feel about it. I can't tell if it's like, oh, this is funny, or like, oh, this is extremely sexist. And I really want to know like how it was received at the time. If it was like satire and people liked it, or if it was like just kind of this guy being rude.
The satire piece of it, it was sort of like, this is the, I don't want to call it the Gilded Age, but the time period where there was a lot of excess.
Stacy said yes, there was probably some old-fashioned sexism to the humor of the poem, but it was also being published at a crucial moment. The Civil War was just a few years away. There's a financial crisis known as the Panic of 1857, and the gap between rich and poor in America is growing.
And so Flora McFlimsey was from New York, and you had all these rich people, and they have all this stuff that they're accumulating, and yet they still don't have enough. This story, this poem that's talking about excess, even in 1857, this was resonating, and it continued to resonate for a while.
The Civil War began shortly after the poem was published. By 1864, it was clear that Union troops would need better supplies to carry on.
As you can imagine, with any kind of turmoil, war, fighting, it's hard to keep up with the supplies and things to just keep people alive.
Groups like the Sanitary Commission and its Women's Association started to raise funds.
They realized with all the letters home from all the different soldiers that a lot of their loved ones were not really being cared for by the federal government. And so the Sanitary Commission was raising funds so that they could help support, send food, send socks, anything for the benefit of their loved one that was fighting this war.
They held a sanitary fair in Logan Square in Philadelphia in 1864 called the Great Central Fair. It was sort of like a church bazaar, like a world's fair in that there were exhibits to see, but also people brought all kinds of objects to sell and then donate the proceeds to the war effort. One of those objects was a beautiful porcelain Victorian doll.
The doll was purchased by Mary Kuhn at the sanitary fair, and she ended up commissioning all the outfits and accessories.
Now, we don't know who made this doll or how they advertised it. We don't even know if the doll originally had a name or a character, but we do know that it was bought by a woman named Mary Kuhn. And Mary commissioned over 100 outfits for the doll, just like Flora McFlimsey in the poem Nothing to Wear.
It's interesting because the records really don't say, what if, we don't know, but what if she just bought a doll and it inspired something, because whatever in Nothing to Wear, the poem, resonated with Mary that she felt like she wanted to do this. And Flora the doll needed her Parisian outfits just as much as Flora in the poem. Who was the seamstress that was working on that? Because can you imagine all these great dresses and clothing for something that's not even 18 inches high? I don't imagine that it was played with. I think it was something that she could display and then change out the outfits. She was a Barbie. Old-timey Barbie.
Flora has wigs and dresses, jackets and skirts, bodices, socks, extra sleeves, extra collars, even a pair of boots.
She could have her winter skating outfit on during the winter season, her summer dress. If she was going to be out on the sleep porch, she would have her little night shift and robe that she would wear, different shoes and her parasol. She does have this look of being well-loved, so I could see, you know, Mary Kuhn, a grown woman, dressing up her doll in the different outfits at different times of the year.
The Atwater Kent collection doesn't just have the doll. It has her whole wardrobe. which requires careful preservation.
For example, we have a great pair of skates and a skating outfit that belongs to Flora McFlimsey, but the leather on the skates is really thin, and so over time, it's gotten a little bit what they call red rot. So some of the leather has gotten powdery. And so there's some things that you can do. We can sort of contain it, let's say. We can't make it fresh again. We can do things to stabilize it.
That's important because while Flora McFlimsey's character was famous at the time, this doll in the Atwater Kent collection is one of a kind. Dolls have been largely homemade things, made out of rags and corn cobs. But the era of the porcelain doll was just beginning. Soon, mass-produced dolls with characters and backstories would be the norm.
I look at Flora McFlimsey, not in shape and style, but having some elements that you can sort of compare to like the American Girl doll, because look at all the things that you can buy, and you can take her to New York and have her go to the salon and have her hair redone and buy all the dresses and clothes and accessories. I think Flora McFlimsey probably would have been an influencer if she were a real person. Totally would have been Instagramming or making TikToks about whatever her latest shoes and the parasol or jewelry that she needed to buy.
Oh my God. That's wild. That's so wild. Okay, because I was thinking very much like this book got so popular that they went into production of like, take home your own Flora. I came in here very prepared for the news that Flora wasn't really played with and was sort of like mass produced and boring. But there was like one doll and Mary Coons made a bunch of dresses. She was so maximalist that she had to have all these outfits for her doll. Very much the equivalent of a TikTok influencer who like does maximalist fashion.
After learning the history, Michaela saw the satire differently, and it resonated in a new way.
Like totally imagining someone living on a townhouse on Delancey Street. She's wealthy enough that she doesn't have to work, buys all these doll clothes, and her husband, who works in whatever fancy rich man job he has, comes home and he's like, "What'd you do today?" And she's like, "Got another Flora outfit." And he's like shaking his head and pouring himself a glass of scotch.
Learning about the sanitary fair also got Michaela thinking about their childhood home in Germantown.
You know what's interesting? The house that I spent half my childhood in, like we moved to when I was 12 and is still where my parents live, was built in the 1850s. It's just like really interesting to be like, oh, I wonder if like the people who lived in my house went to that fair.
That's the same house where baby Evie waited in Michaela's bed when they left for college.
So a few years ago, I was sort of learning new things about myself and exploring myself in deeper ways. And I ended up going through most days feeling really lost. And this made me nostalgic for my childhood and for feeling like I knew who I was back then. I found myself really missing baby Evie. It was like this genderless doll was, you know, calling out to me from far away. So I went home back to my parents' house and I dug through all of the boxes in the closet until I found baby Evie stashed away at the bottom. Something about my parents' house is that it's pretty old and it can be kind of open to the elements. It's drafty. And we've pretty much always had a moth problem there the whole time we've lived there. Like, wool clothes don't really last well. And so I found baby Evie at the bottom of the closet and, you know, I was just looking for this familiar face and figure, the comfort of that. And instead, like, baby Evie had been partially eaten by moths. Baby Evie, it turns out, is stuffed with wool. And yeah, the moths chewed their way through the knit fabric that covered his face and hands. The little pink hat, it was just sort of beyond repair and gross. Her body was fine because it has like the velvet all over it, but her face and hands were like covered in holes and had gross moth debris all over them. Finding her like that was really surprisingly painful and emotional. I felt my past selves inside of my body and like every single reaction they had. So like 2-year-old Michaela was having a temper tantrum. 12-year-old Michaela was angry and yelling. 16-year-old Michaela was sobbing. I wanted to just, like, in a very dramatic way, like, fall on my knees and scream. It was just, like, agony. And it was also surprising that I felt that way. It felt like I had done a disservice of taking care of something that was so precious to my past selves. It sort of felt like this failure to myself. I didn't take care of my baby well enough. Young Michaela would be like, hey, you forgot about what we cared about, you know? So this is baby Evie. Now that the hat isn't there, you can see the original color of the fabric and just how dirty it is now. And that had nothing to do with the moths. That was just time. Baby Evie is still a part of my life. After refinding baby Evie, I brought them back and she now lives in my bed again. Last night when I couldn't sleep because it was too hot, I was holding baby Evie. If you look here, you can see like the holes in the hands that have been sort of nibbled, and there's the wool that I think they were trying to get to underneath. I've been trying to repair some of the damages. I've crocheted 3 hats for this doll now, and none of them are good enough. I thought at one point about getting some of that knit fabric, recovering the head, and redrawing that, but I was like, I will not be able to get the eyes and mouth to look exactly the same, and then it will not be the same doll anymore. Like, those 3 little brush strokes are so much of like what makes this doll real or alive to me. So we're going with the holes. I will still like look at this doll and be like, oh my god, I'm so upset. And so every time I catch myself doing that, I'm just like, this is a reminder of how life is about change. And so this doll changed, and that's okay. The little, I guess, mantra I will say to myself when I look at baby Evie and am feeling like, oh boy, did I screw this up, is to be loved is to be changed. I don't think the moths were super loving, but other than that, I think that like all the wear and tear on baby Evie is the way in which love changes things.
Philadelphia Revealed podcast is a production of WHYY in partnership with Row Home Productions and First Person Arts. Our executive producers are Tom Grassler, Alex Lewis, John Myers, and me, Jamie J. Brunson. This episode of Philadelphia Revealed was written and produced by Jen Kinney. Our lead producer is Jen Kinney. Final mixing and mastering by John Myers and Justin Berger. Story editing from Padmini Raghunath. Our engineers are Al Banks, Diana Martinez, and Charlie Kyer. Special thanks to the Atwater Kent Collection at Drexel University curatorial team. Paige Talbot, Stacy Swigart, Melissa Klemmer, and Michael Shepard. Special thanks also to Dr. Neil Bardhan, Jean Burke Spraker, and Michaela Prell at First Person Arts. Thank you to Michaela Winberg, Hannah Cornish, and Savannah Collins. Our theme music is by Paul Geis and Matt Jernigan. Thanks to Ms. Kramer and the Frankfurt High School Drumline. Additional music by Paul Geis and Blue Dot Sessions. Philadelphia Revealed is a project of Drexel University in collaboration with WHYY and First Person Arts. The Philadelphia Revealed podcast and additional programming has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm Jamie J. Thanks for listening. Philadelphia Revealed is part of the NPR Podcast Network.